Mikael and Natalia. Mikael and Natalia? Not Gary and Barb? My in-laws? The people my kids call Granny and Gramps? I stare at the grooves in the table, these tiny craters. They died in a car crash when I was 13. I didn't have any other family. I was placed into state care, moved a few months later to Moscow. I didn't realize what was happening at the time, but I was placed into an SVR program. I feel a pang of sympathy, thinking of Matt as a scared, orphaned boy. And then it's quickly blunted by an overwhelming sense of betrayal. I clasp my hands even tighter. It was English language immersion for 2 years. When I was 15, I was officially recruited, given a new identity. As Matthew Miller. Again, a whisper. He nods, then leans forward, his eyes intense. I didn't have a choice, Viv. I look down at the rings on my left hand. I think back to those first conversations, finding out we had so much in common. It seemed so real. But it was all made up. He'd created a childhood that never existed. Suddenly, everything is a lie. My life is a lie. My identity wasn't real, but everything else was, he says, almost as if he can read my thoughts. My feelings are real. I swear they are. The diamond on my left hand catches the light. I look at the facets one by one. I'm vaguely aware of sounds from the family room, new sounds, louder sounds. Luke and Ella are arguing. I look up away from my ring and Matt's watching me, but his head is craned just enough that I know he's listening to the kids. Work it out, you two, he calls without taking his eyes off me. We stare at each other, both listening to the kids. The argument intensifies and Matt pushes back from the table, goes into referee. I hear snippets, the kids each trying to argue their side to Matt, his admonishments to compromise. There's a fuzzy feeling in my head. The wine, maybe. Matt comes back holding Caleb and sits down. Caleb grins at me, sticks a drooly fist in his mouth. I can't force my face into a smile, so I just look back at Matt. Who's the real Matt Miller? I ask. I think of the birth certificate buried deep in our fireproof safe, the social security card, the passport. I don't know. What about Barb and Gary? I say. I picture the two of them, the matronly woman, the pastel-colored tops that always remind me of something my grandmother would have worn, the man with the belly that protrudes over his belt, his shirt always tucked in, his socks always white. Others like me, he says. Chase starts crying, a distraction that's strangely welcome. I stand up from the table and walk to the family room. He's on the floor near the couch where Luke and Ella sit, and I can see the outline of a little blue ball wedged underneath. I reach for it, then pick him up, shift him onto my hip. He's quieter now, just little whimpers, the ball tight in his grasp. My thoughts are a jumbled mess. How could I have been so easily duped? Especially when it comes to Barb and Gary. There were red flags, certainly. I didn't meet them until the wedding. We've only been out to Seattle once, and they haven't visited us. There were reasons, of course, ones that made sense at the time, that seem so flimsy now. Barb's afraid to fly. We didn't have enough vacation days. We've had one infant after another, and who wants to risk a screaming baby on a cross-country flight? I felt guilty about it, seeing my parents so often, his barely at all. I even apologized. Life has a habit of getting in the way, he said with a smile. A somewhat sad smile, sure, but he never seemed all that bothered by it. I suggested video chats, but they weren't comfortable with the technology. We're happy just talking on the phone every couple of weeks. Matt seemed fine with it too. And I never pushed it. Did I not push it because secretly I was glad? Glad that we didn't have to alternate Christmases, that we didn't have to bust our budget to fly the family across the country on a regular basis, that I didn't have overbearing in-laws? Maybe even glad that Matt's affections weren't split, that his entire focus could be on the kids and me. I walk back into the kitchen and sit down at the table with Chase on my lap. What about all those people at our wedding? There were at least a couple dozen other relatives there, aunts, uncles, cousins. Same. Impossible. I shake my head like it could put all these random facts into some semblance of order, something that makes sense. I've met upwards of 25 sleepers. How many do the Russians have here? Far more than we thought. Dmitri the Dangle. Suddenly he's all I can think about. He'd said there were dozens of sleeper cells in the U.S. He told us so much that didn't make sense, that made us sure he was a Dangle, that the handlers carried the identities of the sleepers on themselves at all times, when we knew they were stored electronically. The decryption code that didn't match the one we had from other sources, and the outrageous claims that sleepers had infiltrated the government, were slowly working their way to the top, that there were dozens of cells buried here in the States when we thought there were no more than a few. That one wasn't so outrageous after all, was it? And then another realization strikes me. You're a spy, I say quietly. I'd been so focused on the lie, on the fact that he wasn't who he said he was, that I hadn't fully comprehended the obvious. I don't want to be. I want nothing more than to actually be Matt Miller from Seattle, to be free from their grip. There's a heavy feeling in my chest like I can barely catch my breath. But I'm trapped. He looks so sincere, so pitiful. Of course he's trapped. It's not like he can just quit. They have too much invested in him. Chase is squirming on my lap, struggling to break away. I set him down on the floor and he gets on all fours and starts to crawl away, happy little shrieks trailing behind him. You lied to me. I didn't have a choice. You, of all people, should understand. Don't you dare, I say, because I know where he's headed. I picture us, so long ago, the little table in the corner of the coffee shop, oversized mugs in front of us. What do you do for work? He asked. I just finished up grad school, I said, hoping that would suffice, knowing it wouldn't. Do you have a job lined up? I nodded, took a sip of coffee, stalled. Doing what? He pressed. I looked down at my mug, the little puffs of steam that were rising from it. Consulting a small firm, I said, the lie tasting bitter. But he was a stranger, and I wasn't about to tell a stranger I had been hired by the CIA. How about you? I said, and thankfully the conversation turned to software engineering. It's not the same at all, I say now. You've had 10 years. 10 years. I know, he says, contrite. Now Caleb's squirming too, squirming and smiling at me, no doubt wondering why I won't smile back. He stretches his arms out toward me, and Matt holds him up and out over the table at the same time I reach for him. He settles into my lap, calm. Do you do that kind of thing? Pretend to be someone's relative? I ask. I don't know why it matters, why that, of all things, is what I want to know. He shakes his head. They wouldn't want me taking a risk like that. Of course they wouldn't. He's more valuable than that, isn't he? because he's married to me. And I work for the CIA. God, the Russians really scored big with him. They must be thrilled. How lucky is that, a deep cover spy married to a CIA counterintelligence analyst? And then a jolt of cold runs through me like electricity. I picture the two of us in my apartment a few weeks after we'd met, sitting across from each other at the folding table in the corner of the studio, pizza on paper plates in front of us. "I haven't been completely honest with you," I said, wringing my hands, worried how he'd react to my admission of untruthfulness, but relieved to be clearing the air, putting myself in a position where I wouldn't have to lie to this man ever again. "I work for the CIA." I remember his face clearly, unchanged at first, like the news didn't surprise him. Then something flickered in his eyes, and I thought the information just took a moment too long to register. But it didn't, did it? He knew all along. My chest is tight. I close my eyes and I see myself in the grad school auditorium, the presentation from the CIA recruiter, the realization that this is what I could do with my life, a way to make a difference in the world, to serve my country, to make my family proud. Time flashes forward, past the application process, the background investigation, the battery of evaluations, to the day, a year later, after I'd all but given up, when I got the letter in the mail. Generic government return address, plain white paper, no letterhead, just a start date, salary, directions. And the office to which I'd been assigned? The Counterintelligence Center. That was 2 weeks before I moved to Washington and met Matt. My breath is coming fast now. In my head, I'm back in that coffee shop, sitting in that corner, reliving our first conversation, the one where we discovered how similar we were. He didn't just play along, create a persona as he went. He was the first to say he was raised Catholic, that his mom was a teacher, that he had a golden retriever. He said it because he already knew it about me. I raise a hand to my mouth and am vaguely aware it's shaking. The Russians weren't lucky. They were thorough. Everything was intentional, planned. It wasn't serendipitous at all. I was his target. Chapter 4. Matt leans forward again. The crease is deeper, the eyes wider. I'm convinced he can read my thoughts, that he knows the truth that just dawned on me. "I swear everything I feel for you and the kids is real. I swear to God, Viv. I've taken classes in detecting deception, and I'm vaguely aware of the fact that he's showing none of the signs. He's telling the truth. But then, wouldn't he have received the same training? More of it, probably. Wouldn't he know how to convincingly lie? Hasn't he been doing it for 22 years? Caleb's chewing on my finger, tiny sharp teeth digging into my skin. The pain is strangely welcome, and I don't stop it because it's the only thing that feels real right now. "The day we met," I say, and I can't continue. I can't make myself finish the thought, ask what I want to ask. What I already know deep down. It's too much. He takes a moment to respond. "I'd been watching you all morning. When I saw you with that box, I walked in front of you." He looks guilty when he says it. At least he looks guilty. I think of how many times I've told the story of our first meeting, how many times he's told it. How we've each laughed in all the right places, jumped in with our own perspectives. It was all a lie. "You were my target," he says, and my breath catches in my throat. The fact that he'd say it, that's proof he's being honest. It has to be proof, but that's the wife in me speaking, isn't it? The counterintelligence analyst in me says he's telling me what I already know. The oldest trick in the book, a way to try to make himself seem more truthful than he really is. But then I fell in love with you, he says. I fell deeply, deeply in love with you. He looks sincere. And of course he loves me. You don't spend a decade married to someone you don't love. I shake my head. I don't know what to believe anymore. And the thought that he might actually not love me is more than I can wrap my head around. At first, I couldn't get over how lucky I was. It wasn't until much later I realized how awful it is that our relationship is built on a lie, one that I can't share because if I do, everything will come crashing. He stops abruptly and focuses his attention on a spot behind me. I turn and see Luke standing silent in the doorway. I wonder how long he's been there, what he's heard. He looks from Matt to me, his eyes serious, reminding me so much of his father's. "Are you fighting?" he asks in a small voice. "No, sweetie," I say. And my heart breaks for him, though my mind can't fully process why. We're just having a grown-up conversation. He says nothing, just watches us. And for the first time, I realize I can't read his expression, can't tell what he's thinking. He's Matt's son. He's always going to be Matt's son. Maybe I'll never know what he's thinking, whether he's telling me the truth. I have an unsettling sense that my whole life is slipping through my fingers and I'm powerless to stop it. "Dad, can we play catch now?" he asks. "Not now, buddy. I'm talking with Mom." "But you promised, buddy, I..." "Go," I say, interrupting him. It's what I need now. Him gone. Time to think. I stare at him evenly, then add more quietly. "You wouldn't want to lie to him." A wounded expression crosses his face, but that's what I intended, right? Let him be hurt. It's nothing compared to the hurt I feel. And I stare evenly back. Suddenly I'm angry at him, so angry. He betrayed my trust, lied to me for a decade. He looks like he's about to say something, then stops. Still has the hurt expression on his face. He stands up wordlessly, walks around the table, over to where I sit. I continue staring straight ahead at the wall now. He hesitates next to me, then puts a hand on my shoulder. A shiver runs through me at his touch. "We'll talk about all this," he says. His hand stays on my shoulder a moment longer, and then he drops it, follows Luke out of the room. I stay at the table, staring straight ahead, and I listen to them put on jackets, round up mitts and a ball, walk outside. I wait until the door shuts behind them, then I get up, shift Caleb to my hip, and walk over to the sink. I wash them out the window. Father and son, tossing a baseball back and forth in our backyard, dusk settling around them. A perfect snapshot of America. Only one of the two isn't American. And then it dawns on me, hits me with such force I grip the edge of the sink to steady myself. This isn't just betrayal. This isn't something that's going to be solved by a fight or a conversation or anything like that. It's not solvable, period. I need to turn him in. He's a Russian spy, and I need to turn him in. The anger seems to melt away, morph into a river of despair. My gaze drifts to my phone sitting on the counter, the one that holds an endless chain of texts with Matt, countless pictures of our family, our life together. I should be picking it up. I should be calling agency security right now, the FBI, Omar. I look back outside. He's smiling at Luke as he winds an arm back slowly and lets the ball fly, so relaxed, so comfortable. And it's wrong. All of this is wrong because sleepers run. They try to get on planes back home before the authorities can stop them. But Matt's not running. He's not going anywhere. Caleb yawns and I shift him in my arms so he can lay his head against my chest. He snuggles down and lets out a little sigh. I continue to watch Matt through the window. I see him show Luke how to keep legs loose and bouncy, bring the arm back just so. He looks completely normal. He finally casts a glance back at the house, at the kitchen window, right at me, like he knew I'd be there. I meet his gaze and hold it until he turns away, back toward the game. Then I look at the cell phone again. He knows I'm in here, alone, with the phone. A sleeper wouldn't let that happen. A sleeper would protect himself. All the more proof this is Matt, my husband, the man I love, someone who'd never run. We'll talk about all this. His words ring in my head. That's what I need, isn't it? I need to hear what he has to say. And then I have to turn him in. I turn away from the phone. I can't pick it up, not now, not until I've talked to him. And he knows that, doesn't he? The thought comes unbidden and lodges itself in my mind. He knows me. He knows me better than anyone. What if he's not running because he knows I wouldn't pick up the phone right now, wouldn't turn him in? I feel numb. This can't be happening. I shake my head and walk out of the room, away from the window, away from the phone. I step into the family room. Ella's curled up on the couch with a coloring book, crayons splayed on the cushions. I set Caleb down on the floor next to his toys and sink down onto the couch beside her. I feel her forehead warmer now. She brushes my hand away and I wrap my arms around her. "Stop, Mom." She half-heartedly pushes me away, then stops and acquiesces, crayon poised in midair. I kiss the top of her head, the hair that smells like baby shampoo. Her words from earlier are echoing in my head. "Where is Daddy?" And then another phrase, one she never uttered but that I can imagine her saying nonetheless. "Why did Daddy go away?" Caleb's entertaining himself on the floor, banging the lid of his shape sorter against the base, a steady rhythm. Chase has crawled over and is gnawing on one of his stacking cups. They're too young to even remember this, aren't they? The normalcy of our lives now. I watch Ella scribble, the thick crayons clasped tight in her fist, a look of fierce concentration on her face, and tears sting my eyelids. God, how I wish I could protect all of them from this. I hear the back door open, Matt's and Luke's voices mid-conversation, something about Little League. Matt's going to coach this year. Was going to coach. I stand before the tears well any further. "Hi," he says to me when he walks into the room. He looks hesitant, uncertain. "I'll go bathe the twins," I say, avoiding his gaze. I scoop them up, one in each arm, turning my back to Matt. I bring them up to the bathroom, run the water, pour in the cap full of bubbles, let the water fill while I undress them, peeling off clothes and diapers. I set Chase in the water, then Caleb, absent-mindedly run the washcloth over their soft skin, dimpled thighs and bottoms, chubby cheeks, double chins. It seems like just yesterday they were tiny newborns, preemies, that we were bringing them to the doctor for weight checks. Where did the time go? Matt's voice drifts up from the family room. A story. One I know I've read to the kids but can't place right now. I hear Ella giggle. I lean back on my heels and watch the twins play. Chase is grabbing the edge of the tub, pulling himself up, laughing gleefully. Caleb's sitting quietly, mesmerized, marveling at the splash as his little hands hit the water again and again. We only bathe them when we're both home, when one of us can focus on the babies and one on the older kids. It'd be so much harder without Matt. Everything would be so much harder. I get the twins toweled off and in their pajamas, and I hear Matt in the next room getting Ella ready for bed.
"What about my bath?" she says.
"No bath tonight, princess," he says.
"But I want a bath."
When has she ever wanted a bath? "Tomorrow night," he says. Tomorrow night. Will he be around tomorrow night? I try to picture bathing all the kids myself, somehow entertaining the twins while I wash Ella, getting them all into bed alone. The thought seems overwhelming. I put Caleb in one crib, Chase in the other, lay kisses on their cheeks, breathe in their sweet smell. I turn the nightlight on and the overhead light off and step into Ella's room, the one that was going to be sunshine-themed. I had big plans for a mural, a painted ceiling fan, the works. Then work got busy. Now it's a yellow room, bare yellow walls, yellow throw rug. That's as far as I got. She's tucked into the twin-size bed, Matt perched beside her, holding a hardcover book angled so she can look at the pictures. It's the one about the princess firefighter, the one she's picked every night for the past week and a half. She turns to look at me, her eyelids heavy. I give her a smile and stand in the doorway watching them. Matt's doing the voices he always does, and Ella laughs, that little high-pitched giggle. Everything looks so normal, and it hurts to see it. She has no idea. No idea that everything's about to change. Matt finishes the book, kisses her goodnight, and gives me a long look as he stands. I move over to her bedside and kneel down. I kiss her forehead, so warm against my lips. "Sleep tight, sweetheart." Her little arms wrap around my neck, holding me close against her.
"I love you, Mommy."
Mommy. I feel like I might melt, like the emotion I've barely been holding in check might come crashing down. "I love you too, sweetie." I turn off her light and step out into the hallway. Matt's there, near the doorway of Luke's room. "I gave him an extra half hour to read if he got tucked in early," he says quietly. "Figured we could use the time to talk." I nod and walk past him into Luke's room, all blues and baseball and soccer. He's sitting up in bed, a stack of books beside him. He looks so grown up right now. I kiss the top of his head and feel another pull in my chest. It's going to be hardest on him, isn't it? Of all the kids, it's going to be hardest on him. I walk back down into the family room. The house has that eerie quiet after it goes so quickly from chaos to calm. Matt's in the kitchen, washing dishes in the sink. I start picking up, putting the scattered assortment of brightly colored plastic toys back into their bin, taking apart the wooden tracks of Ella's train set piece by piece. We're alone now, just the two of us. We can talk. Why does it matter? I have to turn him in, regardless of what he says. I know that, deep down. But there's a part of me that doesn't believe it, that believes there's a way out of this. I look up at him, still at the sink, now drying a pan with a dish towel. I stop breaking down the train tracks and sit back on my heels. I realize I don't even know where to begin. "What kind of information do you give them?" I finally ask. His hands still, and then he looks up. "Nothing of value. Atmospherics. If you're stressed at work or happy, that kind of thing." "You must give them more than that." I think back to what I might have said over the years that I shouldn't have, and my mind settles on my co-workers. There's a sinking feeling in my chest. Oh, God, Marta, Trey, you're the reason they were pitched, aren't you? We are the reason they were pitched. His face registers surprise, then confusion. No. I'm frantically turning over what I've said to him, that Marta's always the first to suggest an office happy hour, those awkward ones where a dozen people sit in the conference room for a half hour in the afternoon, bags of chips, sometimes a plate of cookies, a few bottles of wine, that she usually brings two, and they're always gone by the end of the day, even though half the office doesn't drink, and she's the only one who ever refills her little plastic cup, and the bottle of whiskey in her bottom drawer. I've told him about that, too. The time I saw her splash some into her coffee. And Trey, I distinctly remember a conversation years ago. He calls Sebastian his roommate, I said to Matt, using air quotes and rolling my eyes. Why doesn't he just admit the truth? It's not like any of us would care. I told you those things in confidence, I whisper now, filled with an overwhelming sense of betrayal. Viv, I swear, I never breathed a word of it. They were pitched, Matt. I'm supposed to believe that's a coincidence? Look, I don't know anything about that, but I promise you I've never said anything about them. I stare at him. He seems sincere, but I don't know what to believe anymore. I shake my head, look down at the train tracks, continue pulling the pieces apart. I hear him go back to drying dishes, putting them away in the cabinets where they belong. We're quiet for a few minutes until he speaks again. I'm telling you the truth, Viv. I haven't told them anything useful, and it doesn't seem to bother them. I think I'm considered a win already. Because you're married to me. Yeah. He looks embarrassed. I toss the last of the train tracks into the bin and close the lid, then slide it over against the wall. That's our family room organization. Clear plastic bins of toys stacked against a wall. Are you loyal to Russia? The words sound so strange coming out of my mouth. I'm loyal to you. I think of the American flag that hangs outside, the 4th of July parades, the sparklers, Matt taking off his cap, hand over heart as he mouths the words to the national anthem at baseball games, the time I heard him telling Luke how lucky we are to live in the greatest country in the world. Russia or America? America, of course, America. You know me, Viv. You know what I believe in. Do I? I was a kid. An orphan. I had no choice. You always have a choice. Not in Russia. I'm quiet. Your loyalty. It was to Russia once. Sure. At first I believed in what I was doing. I was Russian and I was brainwashed. But living here, seeing the truth, I catch sight of a sippy cup wedged behind the toy kitchen and reach for it. Why didn't you tell me? How could I? You've had 10 years. Any single day in the past 10 years. Viv, there's something I need to tell you. And you just say it. He walks over, perches on the armrest of the couch, the dish towels slung over his shoulder. I've wanted to. God, Viv, you don't think I've wanted to? I've come close so many times, but then what? Then I see the look in your eyes, the one I'm seeing now, betrayed, hurt beyond belief. I dreaded that, and I was terrified. What would you do? Take the kids and run? I couldn't lose you. I couldn't lose the kids. You and the kids, his voice cracks, are everything to me. Everything. I say nothing. Finally, he speaks again. I love you, Vivian. I stare at him, that look on his face that seems so sincere, And in my mind, it's 10 years ago, a month after we'd met, a month of seeing each other practically every day. He was walking me home after dark. I can see us on the street outside my apartment, the trees on either side rustling in the breeze, the street lights casting a soft glow. His arm was around my waist, our gait slow and in sync. He just laughed at something I said, something I've long since forgotten. "I love you, Viv," he said. And then he went quiet. Both of us did. The night was suddenly so still. I saw the color creep to his cheeks. He hadn't meant to say it. It had just slipped out, and that made it all the more tender, because it was unfiltered, and he must have really meant it. I thought, sure, he'd try to backtrack. "I love your jokes, Viv. I love spending time with you." Something like that. But he didn't. He stopped, faced me, pulled me close. "I love you, Vivian. I really do." I look down now. I'm holding the sippy cup so tightly my knuckles are white. I can barely choke out the next words. "How could you have brought kids into this?" "Because I wanted a life with you. I wanted you to have everything you'd ever dreamed of."
"But you had to have known that one day..."
"No," he interrupts. His voice is firm. "I didn't. I truly believed that I could do this until you retired, until I retired, and then I could be free from them."
I'm quiet. He's quiet. The whole house is unnervingly quiet.
"They'd have let me stay," he says softly. "It's happened before. I could have lived out the rest of my life and died, and no one would have ever known."
"Could have. Would have." The tense is jarring. He knows we can't just pretend this didn't happen, that I didn't learn about this. He knows I have to turn him in. He gives me a weak smile.
"If only you weren't so good at your job." The words make my stomach turn. If I hadn't pushed for that algorithm, none of this would have happened. I bring the sippy cup into the kitchen, unscrew the top, put both pieces on the top rack of the dishwasher. He's watching me, silent. I close the dishwasher and lean on the counter. He walks into the kitchen and stands behind me, tentatively, like he's not sure what I'll do, how I'll react. I'm not sure either. But I don't move. I let him take a step closer, put his hands on my shoulders, slide them down to my hips until he's holding me close. My body softens into the familiar embrace, and when I squeeze my eyes shut, a single tear escapes from each one. In my mind, I'm back on that street outside my apartment, leaning into his kiss, pressing against him, wanting more, stumbling into the building, up the stairs, feeling his touch, seeing the look in his eyes, the hunger that was there. And afterward, lying together on tangled sheets, intertwined, waking up in his arms, watching as his eyes opened and he took in my presence, the slow smile that spread across his face. All of that was real. It had to be.
"What am I supposed to do now?" I say quietly.
A rhetorical question, really, voiced to my best friend, the one I've always turned to, relied on, my partner, my rock. Or maybe it's a lifeline.
"Get me out of this. Tell me what to do to make this all disappear."
"There's only one thing you can do." He buries his head in the space between my neck and shoulder, and I feel the scratch of his stubble. A shiver runs through me. "Turn me in."
Chapter 5. The words don't seem real at first. He's supposed to be trying to talk me out of it. But instead, there's just silence. a gaping hole where that conversation should have been. And I feel like I'm dangling over the edge of it, about to lose everything. And then something changes in me, like a switch flipped. I swivel around to face him. He doesn't move back, stays close to me, close enough that I can breathe in his scent, feel his warmth. There has to be another way, I say. He shouldn't be admitting defeat, throwing in the towel. He moves away, and I feel a rush of cold air where he had been standing. He walks over to the cabinet, pulls out a wine glass, sets it down beside mine. I watch him, my mind trying to sort through what's happening. He pours wine into each glass, then hands me mine. There's not. There's always... There's not, Viv. Trust me. I've thought through everything. He picks up his glass and takes a long sip. I've had plenty of time to think about it, about what to do if this day ever came. I stare down at my own glass. I shouldn't drink this. I need my head as clear as possible right now. But at the same time, the thought of drinking enough to make all of this disappear is strangely attractive. "What else do you want to know?" he asks quietly. He's already moving on. That part of the conversation is done in his mind. Turn him in. That's what I'm supposed to do. He doesn't have a plan, a way to get us out of this. It's not done in my mind, not at all. I shake my head stubbornly, and then I consider his question. What else do I want to know? I want to know if you're being completely honest with me, if I can trust you 100%, if we're really on the same team. I look up and meet his eye. Everything. He nods like he expected the answer, swirls the wine around in his glass, then sets it down and leans back against the counter. I have a handler. His name's Yuri Yakov. I keep my face impassive. Tell me about him. He splits time between Russia and the U.S. He's the only other person I know involved in this. It's so heavily compartmented. How do you communicate? Dead drops. Where? Northwest D.C., our old neighborhood. Where exactly? You know that bank on the corner with the domed roof? There's a little courtyard around the side, two benches. It's the one on the right, the one that faces the door. The drop spot is under the bench on the right side. That is awfully specific, and it isn't all information I already know. This is new, valuable. How often do you meet? Whenever one of us signals. On average, once every 2 or 3 months. Every 2 or 3 months? I swallow past a lump in my throat. We'd always assumed handlers spent most of their time in Russia, meeting sleepers in the U.S. infrequently every year or two, or in third countries. Yuri has only a limited record of travel to the U.S., short trips. That means he's here under an assumed identity, doesn't it? How do you signal? I ask. Chalk on the bench, just like the movies. He gives a weak smile. I could press the issue. I could find out if there's special chalk, where exactly the mark is made, what it looks like. And that would be enough information to lure Yuri there, find him, arrest him. Or, the CI analyst in me says, he'd play me, give me instructions on how to signal that he'd been compromised, how to ensure Yuri would disappear. My throat tightens. What do you leave? What do you pick up? Encrypted flash drives. How do you decrypt? You know the storage area behind our stairs? There's a false floorboard. A laptop's inside. The answers are coming fast. No signs of deception. I try to ignore the fact that the laptop is hidden in our home and think of what to ask next. And you don't tell him anything I tell you? He shakes his head. I swear, Viv, I don't. You've never mentioned Marta or Trey? Never. I look down at my wine. I believe him. I do. But I don't know whether that makes sense. I look back up. Tell me what you know about the program. You probably know more than I do, really. It's hierarchical, self-contained. I only know Yuri. Beyond that, I have no idea. I swirl the wine around in my glass and watch it cling to the sides. I picture myself at my desk, the intelligence gaps I have, the things I always wish I knew. Then I look back up. How do you get in touch with Moscow? Like if something happened to Yuri, who would you contact? How? I wouldn't. Not for a year. We're under strict instructions not to, for our own safety. SVR moles or whatever. I'm supposed to just hang tight, wait until someone steps into Yuri's place and makes contact with me. That's what I was afraid of. An answer, a program design that makes finding handlers and ringleaders nearly impossible. But something he said is sticking in my head. Something new. A year. What happens after a year? I get back in touch. How? There's an email address. I'd go to another state, create a new account. There's a whole list of protocols. It makes sense, what he's saying. I always wondered what would happen if the replacement handler couldn't access the names of the five agents. Turns out the sleepers themselves would get back in touch. I'm sorry, I don't know more, but I think it's intentional. So that if any one agent goes rogue, the program stays intact. He trails off, shrugs, a helpless look on his face. Of course it's intentional. I know that, don't I? He gave me as much as I could possibly expect him to know, without hesitation, without any sign of deception. He drains the last of his wine and sets the glass down on the counter. Anything else? I look at the defeat on his face, the look of a man who's powerless to help. Matt's never powerless. He's the one who can fix anything, solve any problem, do anything. I shake my head. I don't know. He gives me a long look, then casts his eyes to the floor, shrugs. Then let's just get some sleep. I follow him up to our bedroom, our footsteps heavier than usual on the stairs. I think of the laptop hidden in our storage area. An SVR laptop in my home. One my husband uses to exchange secret messages with his Russian handlers. In our room, Matt heads for the closet. I walk the other way toward the bathroom. I close the bathroom door and stand silently, alone for the first time, then sink down to the floor and sit with my back against the door. I'm drained, exhausted, overwhelmed. The tears should come. The emotion that's building inside me should be crashing down. But it's not. I just sit and blink into space, my mind numb. Finally, I make myself stand. I brush my teeth and wash my face, and I come out of the bathroom, ready to turn the cramped space over to Matt so he can get ready for the night. But when I come out, I don't see him. Not in the closet, not in our bed. Where is he? I walk down the hall, and then I see him. He's standing in the doorway of Luke's room. I see just his profile, but it's all I need to see. There are tears streaming down his cheeks. It shocks me to the core. In the 10 years I've known him, it's the first time I've seen him cry. In bed, we lie silently. I listen to Matt's breathing, even but fast, and I know he's awake. I blink again into the darkness, my mind struggling to craft thoughts into words. There has to be another way out. Turning him in can't be the only option. I roll on my side, face him. There's enough light from the nightlight in the hallway to see his face. You could quit,
He turns his head toward me. You know I can't do that.
Why? Maybe you...
They'd probably kill me. Or at the least, destroy me.
I watch his face carefully, the creases in his forehead, the eyes that look like they're processing the suggestion, sorting through the consequences.
He turns his head back so that he's looking up at the ceiling. Matt Miller doesn't exist without the SVR. If they take away my identity, where would I go? How would I live? I roll to my back, look up at the ceiling, too.
Then we could go to the FBI.
To Omar, our friend, the man who wanted to allow sleepers to come out of the shadows and exchange information for immunity. And say what?
Tell them who you are, give them information, make a deal.
Even as I say them, the words sound hollow. The Bureau rejected Omar's plan, swiftly and thoroughly. What's to say they'd agree? I don't have enough to give. I have nothing valuable to trade.
The agency, then, you could offer to be a double.
Now? Look at the timing. 2 decades of silence, and then I offer to work as a double now when you're closing in on me? They'd never believe I'm sincere.
He turns to face me.
Besides, I always said I'd never do that. If it were just me, fine. But I wouldn't put you and the kids in danger like that. It's too much of a risk.
My heart aches. Then I'll quit. If you weren't married to a CIA officer,
they know you wouldn't. They know about our financial situation.
There's a strange feeling swirling around inside of me, thinking of the Russians knowing the details of our lives, of our vulnerabilities, of just how trapped we are. I try to ignore it, focus on the issue at hand. Then I'll get myself fired.
They'll see through it, and anyway, then what? What if they order me to leave you?
Our bedroom door creaks the smallest bit, and I look up to see Ella standing there, framed in the light from the hallway, hugging her ratty, stuffed dragon close to her chest.
Can I come sleep in your bed?
She asks, then sniffles. She's looking to Matt for an answer, but I'm the one who responds.
Sure, sweetie.
Of course she can. She's sick, isn't she? And I've been so preoccupied with Matt, I haven't paid her any attention, provided any comfort. She climbs up, scoots in between us, settles herself in, pulls the sheet up to her chin, adjusts it under the dragon's chin, too. And then the room is quiet again. I stare at the ceiling, alone with my fears. I know Matt is doing the same. How could either of us sleep right now? I feel Ella's warmth beside me. I hear her breathing slow down, become softer. I look over at her, the little mouth open, the halo of baby fine hair. She rustles in her sleep, sighs softly. I look away, back at the ceiling. I almost can't bring myself to say the words, but I have to.
What if we all go to Russia?
I whisper.
I couldn't do that to you and the kids, he answers quietly. You'd never see your parents again. None of you know Russian. The education there, the opportunities. And Caleb, the medical care, the surgeries, he wouldn't have the same life there.
We lapse back into silence. I feel tears stinging my eyes at the helplessness of it all. How is there no other solution? How is this our only option?
They'll probably start an investigation, he finally says. I roll back on my side so that I'm facing him again, looking at him over Ella sandwiched between us. He turns to face me, too. When you tell security, they'll watch my comms. I don't know how long, but we won't be able to breathe another word of this anywhere, anytime. I picture our house bugged, a room full of agents listening to every word of what we say to the kids, to each other, all of it being transcribed. Analysts like myself poring over every word. For how long? Weeks?
months even? Never, ever admit that you told me, he goes on. You need to be there for the kids. My mind flashes back to those warning screens on Athena, the non-disclosure agreements I've signed. That was classified information, highly classified, compartmented information. And I shared it. Promise me you won't admit it, he says, an urgency in his voice. My throat feels unbearably tight. I promise, I whisper. I see the relief on his face. And I'll never tell either, Viv. I swear. I'd never do that to you. Matt falls asleep. I don't know how, because I can't. I watch the minutes pass in fluorescent green until I can't take it any longer. I go downstairs, the house dark, filled with a heavy silence that seems so lonely. I turn on the television, filling the room with a flickering bluish glow, tuned to some mindless reality show, bikini-clad women and shirtless men drinking, fighting. I finally realize I'm not catching a word and shut it off. The blackness returns. I have to turn him in. We both know it. It's the only way. I try to picture myself doing it, sitting down with security or with Peter or Bert and telling them what I found. It seems impossible, traitorous. This is Matt, the love of my life. And then there's our kids. I try to imagine telling them Matt's gone away, that he's in jail, that he lied, wasn't who he said he was. And later when they learn that I'm the reason he was sent away, that they grew up without a father. I hear Matt's alarm at 6:30. The shower turns on a minute later, like any other morning, like this was all a dream. I go upstairs and dress, my favorite pantsuit. I put on some makeup, run a comb through my hair. Matt comes out of the shower, a towel around his waist, and kisses the top of my head, like he does every morning. I smell his soap, watch him in the mirror as he moves on over to the closet. Ella's burning up, he says. I go to the bed, put my hand against her forehead. Yeah, she is. Guilt runs through me. I hadn't even thought to check. I'll work from home. Can you drop the twins off on your way in? Of course. I watch him in the mirror, and an unsettled feeling comes over me, like maybe this was all a dream. How can he act like everything's normal when our lives are about to fall spectacularly apart? The rest of the morning is our usual chaos. We get the twins and Luke dressed and fed, our tag-team routine. I catch myself looking at him more than I should, like one of these times he'll be a different person, but he's not. He's Matt, the man I love. I bring Ella down to the couch, get her settled under a blanket, her crayons and coloring book at her side. I kiss her goodbye, kiss Luke goodbye. Then I pick up Caleb and Matt picks up Chase, and wordlessly we get the twins into their car seats. When they're all strapped in, we stand awkwardly together in the driveway, just the two of us. I'm going to do this, aren't I? There's no other choice. I wanted to come up with something, some way out. But there's no way out. I need to say something to him, but I can't find the words. He smiles at me sadly, almost as if he can read my thoughts. It's okay, Viv. I don't see another way, I say, my voice heavy with apology. I thought about it all last night. I know. If it were just you and me, then going there would be an option. But the kids, and Caleb especially. I know. It's okay, Viv. Really. He hesitates, and I can tell he wants to say something else. He opens his mouth, then closes it again. What is it? It's just... He trails off, starts wringing his hands. Money'll be tight, he finally says. And then he lets out a choking sob, one that sends terror into me, because Matt doesn't lose control like this. I move toward him, wrap my arms around his waist, my cheek against his chest. I feel his arms encircle me, that embrace that's always felt so safe, so much like home. God, I'm sorry. Viv, what have I done? What's this going to do to the kids? I don't know how to respond. Couldn't get my mouth to work, even if I did. He pulls away and takes a deep breath. I just wish none of this had happened. A single tear slides down one cheek. Whatever you found, I wish I could make it disappear. So do I, I whisper. I watch the tear cut a path all the way to his chin. There's something else on my mind, something I need to say, but I don't know how to say it. Finally, I force out the words. You can go, you know. I can't help but think how strange, how sad, that it's come to this. 10 years, 4 kids, a life together, and now a goodbye in the driveway? He looks at me, incredulous, then shakes his head sadly. There's nothing for me back there. I understand. He puts his hands on my shoulders. My life is here. He looks so sincere when he says it. Still, if you change your mind, at least call a sitter. He drops his arms, looks like a wounded animal. I'm not even sure why I said it. It's not like I really think he'd leave Ella alone. I don't know what else to say to him. And even if I did, I don't know if I could get the words out without breaking down. So I look away, get into the car, turn the key in the ignition. It starts the first time. What are the odds of that? I throw it into reverse and watch him watch me as I pull away, down the driveway, away from the life I know, the one we built together. And only then do I start to cry. A steady stream of cars passes through the checkpoints, the ones manned by armed officers. The color-coded parking lots are starting to fill. Thousands work here at headquarters. I walk from one of the far lots to the office in a daze. Numb. My footsteps feel heavy. Others trudge past me on either side of the wide concrete walkway. I look at the manicured landscaping off to my right, the plants, the colors, because it's better than thinking about what's next. It's better to pretend that none of this ever happened. Warm air hits me as I walk through the automatic doors into the lobby. I focus my attention on the giant American flag hanging from the rafters of the atrium. Today it seems ominous, taunting. I'm about to betray the man I love most in the world. Because I have no choice. Because of that flag, my country, and the fact that it's not, in fact, his country too. The security officers are at the turnstiles, watching, observing, as always. Ron, the one I see here most mornings, the one who never smiles even when I smile at him. Molly, the one who always looks bored. People are queued up, waiting to scan badges and enter codes. I join the line, removing hat and gloves, smoothing out my hair. Why do I feel nervous, like I'm doing something wrong? It makes no sense, none at all. I'm going to tell Peter first. I decided on the drive-in. I need to practice getting